The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show. A lot to get to on today's program. Well, here in the UK, we've heard a lot about babies through the week at a hospital in London on Monday. The Duke and Duchess of Cambridge welcomed their third child into the world, a baby boy. So everything went smooth with the delivery there. But that same day, doctors in a Liverpool hospital turned off the life support machine for a 23-month-old Alfie Evans. And he had been, had some kind of a degenerative disease for the most of his life. I think he had been in the hospital for over a year. In any event, it's been on the news quite a lot over here, and it's gaining some international attention as well, for reasons that I'll explain in just a moment. But Alfie's parents, Tom and Kate, they were very much opposed to the decision, even fighting against that decision in court. But they keep losing. So this little child, almost 2 years of age, he suffers from an undiagnosed brain condition of some kind. And he's been on life support, as I say, for more than a year. And a panel of doctors decided, I think it was a couple of months ago, that it would be in the baby's interest. Sorry, where did my voice go? Quick drink of water. This panel of doctors decided several weeks back that they would take him off of life support. This was in the interest of the baby, they said. So it's somewhat similar to another story from about a year ago, Charlie Gard, who was also taken off life support against his parents' wishes. But in this particular case, Italy, the nation of Italy, offered to grant Alfie Italian citizenship so that the family could then move to Italy and receive experimental care at an Italian hospital. And yet the British High Court intervened to say that they can't do it. They can't go to Italy. They can't leave the country. They're stuck in Britain. The British courts refused to let them go. And now, I guess, after giving up on any thought of going to Italy, the parents, as of today, are just trying to get their baby home. It's interesting because this panel of doctors, or at least the doctor that was working with Tom Evans, he's the father, a young man about 20 years of age, I guess, and he's been giving interviews, I think, every day outside this hospital. There have been quite a few people that have gathered to protest in favor of the Evans here, but he said that the doctor told him that as soon as the baby's taken off of life support, he'd no doubt die within a few minutes. Well, that was on Monday. And as of today, it's Thursday, and that little baby is still alive. Here's what, listen to what this British MEP, Stephen Wolfe, had to say during, I think this was a radio interview earlier this week. Here's clip two.
What we now know is we're 25 hours after they've taken that tube out of Alfie's mouth and he's breathing on his own. For the first 6 hours, they wouldn't give him any water. We forced them to give some water. They're refusing to give any antibiotics now for a chest infection that he had. He's had no food for 25 hours. There is a determination, I think, to kill that child and to make sure he doesn't get across to Italy.
A pretty serious charge there coming from Stephen Wolfe. I forget which party he represents. But a determination. I mean, they've been caring for the kid, the NHS, for over a year. But now the decision has been made, basically, and they took him off of life support. And for a number of hours, he had no water. And they didn't treat him, as he said there, for this chest infection. I'll read more about some of the background there in just a moment. But as I say, the parents now, I mean, they've given up hope of going to Italy. The high court won't let them. And they're really at the mercy of the hospital staff now as to whether they can take little Alfie home. That's what they're focused on as of today. This is a clip from the father earlier this morning, clip 15.
What we do today is we have a meeting with the doctors at all today, and we now start asking to go home. Because if this was a child of being extubated in a good way, he'd be on a ward by now. Alfie don't need intensive care no more. Alfie does not need intensive care. Alfie is lying on the bed with 1 liter of oxygen going into his lungs, and the rest is him.
Now, this father happens to believe that the baby's been misdiagnosed, and of course the doctors disagree with that, but that's why they want to take the baby to Italy, because they feel like there's still hope for little Alfie. But at the very least, I mean, the doctors are wrong about the fact that the baby wouldn't be able to survive off of life support, at least to this point. 3 days on. This is from Red State over in the States. It says, at issue in this case are two entities in power, the courts and the medical professionals. While in general, one may say these authorities are a voice of empirical reason, there are serious questions about the actions of each in this case. It says that these two powers demonstrate serious flaws in their actions, makes their overriding the wishes of the mother and father all the more infuriating. Where are the rights? Where's the freedom for this family, for this mother and father? That's what it's getting at here. Let us begin with the doctors of the hospital staff. Here it gives some of the background in this case. They're the ones dictating that the humane thing to do was removing the ventilators keeping Alfie alive and issuing palliative techniques so he can pass away with the least discomfort, except these doctors had been proven unable to successfully diagnose Alfie's condition. Once they honed in on a possible cause, they still struggled with how to treat him. Additionally, once Alfie was admitted to their hospital, he contracted a chest infection, leading to his being in a coma. So he got into the hospital, and you could argue that he got worse. It says, it is inside this same hospital that the parents are commanded that Alfie must remain. Now, the staff, who have been stymied as to diagnosing at the facility where he contracted an additional illness, are declaring they know what is best for the infant. That is the removal of care so that he may expire. They struggled to address his condition accurately, and he became sicker in their facility. But now they are unimpeachable experts regarding the same child. So they've made their mistakes. But now, I mean, their say is final. Now, the hospital staff, I guess they're getting together today to decide whether or not the baby can go home. And who knows what will happen there. But look at the authority. Look at the control. Look at the freedoms that so many Brits have sacrificed or given up without even a fight. This Stephen Wolf, he was also on a TV program earlier this week. Here's another clip from him, clip one.
What I found in my time looking at this case and previous to that of the Aisha King and also Charlie Gard is that we have an institutional arrogance, a belief that they can never do anything wrong. And as a consequence of that, they are willing to make the decision to end life, notwithstanding the fact that there are alternative options out there. Take the case of Aisha King. They said very clearly, the trust, that the child would die. There was no way, and they had to end life. It took the father taking the child out of the country, and now what do we know about Aisha King? Perfectly alive. And in this case of Alfie Evans has now been breathing for 19 hours, not 9 hours, as you just said, 19 hours, when the hospital trust told Justice Hayden in February that once you extubate, he will be dead within minutes or at least a very short period of time.
So that's British MEP Stephen Wolfe pointing out with these previous cases. I don't know much about the Aisha King case, but here's an instance where the parents took the baby out of the country. And that child is perfectly alive today, as the MP brings out. But with Alfie Evans, they can't leave. They can't go to Italy. It's this institutional arrogance, as Mr. Wolf brings out here, a belief that they can never do anything wrong. That is dangerous. When you have a state, in this case, and the NHS, I mean, that's an arm of the government. It's national health care, the National Health Service. If you have an institution such as that, this overarching institution that believes it can never do anything wrong, that is a dangerous kind of institutional arrogance. Listen to this exchange. This was on, I think this was this morning, or maybe yesterday morning, from Good Morning Britain. This is Piers Morgan having an exchange with one of the higher-ups in the NHS. Clip three.
My problem, it was the same with the guard situation, really.
Charlie Guard, yeah.
Is that miracles do happen. Sometimes the doctors just get it wrong. Most of the time, 99% of the time,
miracles
they get
don't
it right.
Happen.
They miracles
don't
happen. Do
happen. No, they don't happen. You know, you've got a whole
you don't think any,
panel
let
of
me just,
doctors
let me just
here.
Ask, let me just grill you on that. So you don't believe that any children ever recover when the
not
medical opinion has been they can't?
Not in...
We know there are cases...
No, not in this.
Do.
That's not a miracle. That's
what
not
is
a
that?
Miracle. That is maybe a misdiagnosis or a diagnosis which is not quite correct.
So doctors can get it wrong. They are fallible.
Wrong? Yes, of course, of course. But when you look at a whole consensus of doctors, all of whom are very experienced, all of whom are compassionate and caring, they've got the scans, they've got the records, they can see what's happening, you know, they're very, very rarely wrong. And they're not making a value judgment here.
That's, I forget what his name is, Dr. Hillary Jones on Good Morning Britain. And there's Piers Morgan. Well, I mean, we could go on this program about miracles and what the Bible has to say about fools that say in their heart, there is no God. But the arrogance, I mean, he allows for the fact that there could possibly be a mistake. But when you have a consensus like this, a panel... Remember what Sarah Palin said about death panels? And she was ridiculed for that years ago. She said, if you go in the direction of nationalized health care, this is what it will lead to. It'll be the panel in the end deciding your fate. And that's what's happening here. But there's something bigger at play, as I'll get to in just a second. But they're very, very rarely wrong. When they have a consensus... And they're all compassionate. That's what you just heard him say there. They all care. They care, presumably they care more about Alfie than Alfie's parents. Back to that that piece at Red State. It says, meanwhile, the courts have been a constant source of madness in ruling that the parents cannot act in what they feel is their son's best interest. It says, to start, the court has taken control of Alfie's life by invoking in loco parentis. This is a precedent that effectively declares the court or other authority can take the place of the parent. They're the parents. The NHS, they're the parents. Or the High Court, they're the parents. Clearly, this is not being done due to absent or otherwise incapacitated guardians. The parents are present. They're very much invested. They're very much invested in their son's best interests. The court is brazenly declaring here that it simply knows better. That's what's sad about this. I mean, I've been giving quite a few programs of late about the absence of fathers. About the absence of male authority. And these two are very young parents, and judging by their last names, I'm assuming they're not married. But at least the father's there. You have to give the young man credit. He's there fighting for his son. But there's only so much that he can do. If he wants to remove his son from the National Healthcare Service, he has to get their approval, and he can't leave the country. He can't go to Italy. It's an upside-down world. You think about just how upside-down it is. if little Alfie was still in the womb, I mean, it would totally be the mother's decision on whether or not to terminate that life. She would have control. But then he's born, and then he's put into the NHS system, and then it's the NHS that has control. This is the state of Britain today. The champion of freedom. We'll get into that in just a bit. But let's first address this other point on why they won't let Alfie Evans go to Italy. There's plenty of points that have been made over the years about what happens when you have a single-payer system like what people have here in the UK, that over time, if you're getting, you know, certain people are going to be denied certain care or surgeries or this or that because of the cost to the system. You've got to look at the bottom line. I mean, this is a system that's very much burdened down with escalating costs. But here was a case where Italy not only offered an honorary citizenship, they offered to transport Alfie to Italy, which would not only remove Alfie from the NHS system, I mean, it would remove the cost of all of the treatment, the life support, and so on. And so the question is, why wouldn't British authorities say, well, help yourself, go for it. I hope it works out. Maybe we did get it wrong. Well, it gets back to what Mr. Wolf said in that clip I just played. This institutional arrogance. We know best. Look, we've made the decision. He's off life support. He's going to have to die. He was going to die anyway. Red State says this. Even after Alfie surprised doctors with his will to live, he was denied water for nearly 6 hours. He continued to be denied nourishment. With the denial of his exit from England altogether, it was clear that the British courts and the NHS had no intention of letting Alfie live. But why? Why? And it goes on to explain that, you know, again, if Italy's taking on the costs here, it seems like it would be a win-win situation. It's no longer a burden on the NHS system. And then the parents would have the freedom to go try something else, even if experimental. It says here, I may not agree with such reasoning. Well, it talks about the system and again, how that, let me just back up. It says, though still morally squishy, there's a valid argument to be made that when a nation votes for socialist healthcare, they're agreeing to let the government treat their lives as algorithms. When the bottom line is measured in dollars rather than lives, the risk a society takes is illustrated in cases like Alfie's. The NHS simply cannot afford the extremely expensive prospect of keeping alive a little boy who most likely will not live much longer due to an incurable condition. Alfie's chances of any meaningful recovery were slim to none. It isn't outside the boundaries of reason that the government tasked with this treatment would deem it simply not worth the effort expended. It's cruel but logical, the inevitable result of a single-payer system. I may not agree with such reasoning, but I can at least derive the path that such woeful decisions must take place, must take in place like the UK. But it says here, what's not logical and nearly incomprehensible is the decision of the court not simply to deny Alfie further treatment, but then deny his right and the right of his parents to leave the country to seek treatment elsewhere. It says further on, let's ponder this just for a moment, the fact that he's barred from leaving the country. It says, Great Britain is a nation with a proud history of freedom and democracy. Most other nations around the world, and Britons themselves, would describe it as a free country, and yet here is a case where its free citizens are not allowed to leave its borders. And see, what it boils down to here is control. Control. The doctors are better guardians of this child's interests than the parents. The doctors are always right, It's like they can never do anything wrong. It says, how would it look if Alfie were allowed to leave England and then found a successful treatment in another country? I guess like this other gal that was mentioned by Stephen Wolfe. Aisha, I guess was her name. How would it look? It would be an abject embarrassment to a government that holds up their socialist health care as one of the wonders of the Western world. Not only would they be forced to admit that their own doctors and bureaucrats were wrong for denying this baby life-saving measures, but they would then have to deal with hundreds, maybe thousands of other citizens fleeing the bondage of NHS. It says, for some bizarre reason, a nation that boasts figures like Winston Churchill and Margaret Thatcher, a tiny island nation that was once so powerful and proud, it was said that the sun never set on the British Empire. For some inexplicable reason, that nation has chosen to hang its pride and joy on socialized medicine. Dennis Prager produced this video. I forget how long ago this was. Richard sent it to me this morning. But the title of it is, if you love, or rather live in freedom, thank the British Empire. That's what's pretty amazing here when you see this. And there are other examples besides just this little boy and the inability of his parents to leave for Italy. There's other examples, many others, and not just in the UK, but in the US as well, where you clearly see the erosion of freedom. And yet, as Prager brings out in this video, I mean, if you have any freedom to speak of, you can pretty much thank the British Empire. Listen to just a bit of this video. Here's clip 4.
Over the last 400 years, what power has done the most to spread the ideals of limited government, an independent judiciary, certain inalienable rights, and free markets? That power would be the British Empire. It was Britain that gave these ideals to the United States. It was the British Empire, the largest empire the world has ever known, which made these ideals global aspirations. It was the British Empire, along with America, that defended these ideals in two colossal world wars. Freedom was an Englishman's right, and wherever he went, he took that right with him, whether he was an English colonist in America, governing himself through a locally elected assembly, or an English adventurer like Sir Stamford Raffles, creating the free market city-state of Singapore, or an English officer like T.E. Lawrence, leading Arab tribesmen against the Turks. The British always thought of themselves as liberators, as bringers of freedom. The British believed the final and necessary justification of their empire was a moral one. The British kept the peace. They brought sound, honest administration. And they insisted that basic moral standards were honored. The British did not try to nation build in the way we think of it now. They were under no illusions about making Arabs or Afghans or Zulus into Englishmen. They were more than content to leave people alone, to let them be themselves, to govern them with the lightest possible hand.
That's the way that it once was. The champion of freedom. If you live in it, you can thank the British Empire. It was content to just leave people alone. Not that they didn't uphold the rule of law. They certainly did. The Judeo-Christian ethic. They upheld that. They upheld the laws based on the Ten Commandments. And then let people be themselves and governed over them with the lightest possible hand. In other words, it wasn't meant ever for the British Empire or for America. It was never meant to have this overbearing government, this massive, sprawling government entity interfering in every little aspect of our lives. Now, we can't blame our problems today on the governments in our land. They are corrupt. They are overgrown. There is waste. There's a warped sense of priorities all throughout, but as even the founders of the United States said over and again from the very beginning. It's religion and morality that's going to hold everything together here. And if you lose that, this is not going to work. For many people, I mean, government is God. The NHS is God. You heard the man on that morning show. There's no such thing as miracles. And when we have a consensus of doctors, I mean, we very, 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 very rarely get it wrong. We're always right. We know what's best. We have compassion. We're caring. Every one of us. That's quite a statement to make. I'm sure they're all very well educated, those doctors. But they're also very human. And human beings are flawed, and human beings make mistakes. And it's made worse when we're arrogant. Pride comes before the fall. That applies to all of us. But here you look back at Britain's history, even recent history. I've mentioned before our book club going through Manchester's a series on Churchill. We're in the midst of, or just starting now, the second volume there. Probably the best one of the three. And boy, you see what Britain fought for in World War II. They fought for freedom. They sacrificed the lives of many of their young men for the spread of freedom. You heard it there in that video. Limited government and freedom. Freedom was an Englishman's right. And yet we see in our nations today, the United States and Britain, both of them, so many of our citizens, they're quite happy to give up freedoms so long as they're promised some freebies in return. And many, believe me, I've talked to a few of them, many people here in the UK, they cherish their national healthcare system. The politicians in London, they love it. They want to provide more funding. And it's always sold on the with the language that, well, this is the caring and the compassionate thing to do. That anyone and everyone can show up and get some service. And maybe, you know, in this world, there is something to be said for that. But you see the darker side with cases like what we've seen in the UK this past week. It's not just this, though. If you look at the British authorities and just the sense of priorities or lack thereof, there have been a number of articles just this week. Well, this instance with Alfie, there was a case up in Scotland where, and again, it was juvenile and vulgar. This Scottish man who taught his girlfriend's dog how to do a Nazi salute and so on. It was meant to be a joke. But he's been prosecuted and fined something like £800. For a video that he made about a dog responding to some kind of Nazi slogan. And other cases, a case of an angry motorist driving down the way. He makes an obscene gesture to the speeding cameras. And then they investigate this guy because everyone's on camera. They investigate this guy and find out that he has some kind of device in his car that jams those lasers that check your speeding, and those are illegal. He's going to jail for 8 months. And so there have been commentators at The Spectator and elsewhere talking about, look, I mean, you have 3,000 jihadis in the UK. And yet you see where the focus is. The focus is on these kinds of things. There have been a lot of stories about the knife crime. I've got them later on in my notes here. I mean, it's just skyrocketing. I reported earlier about the number of murders in London. Most of them with knives, the killers using knives. And now, as you've probably seen this past week, I mean, there's a war on knives. They've confiscated the guns. Now they're going after the knives. I mean, this is the way, this is the thinking. It's embedded into the system. Take away this, take away that. You can do this. No, you cannot do that. And meanwhile, morally, I mean, morally, anything goes. As to the Judean Christian ethic, never mind any of that. It's all according to political correctness or the standards of today, the standards of morality today. But what a rich, glorious history Britain once had. An empire that celebrated peace. Listen to, again, another clip or two from this PragerU video. Here's clip 5.
In American history, we remember this when we think of the British Empire's so-called benign neglect. We can see it throughout the history of the British Empire. Think about the vast territory of the Sudan. It was governed by 140 British civil servants. Even Gandhi praised the British Empire, paraphrasing Jefferson, saying that he believed that the best government was the government that governed least, and that he found that the British Empire guaranteed his freedom and governed him least of all.
That's the way people used to see colonialism or the British Empire, not to say that there were never any injustices. Today, though, I mean, it's a bad word. That's the great evil of our history, so many think today. And yet, what is the truth? It's brought out in a little simple 5-minute video that young people today are not, they're not being educated in this, though. They don't know about this. And they're gradually, this creeping socialism, they're just gradually turning over their freedoms to the state. At The Spectator this week, it says, on freedom of speech, Britain has become the laughingstock of the Western world. People actually laugh at us. And this author says here, I recently gave a talk in Brazil on political correctness, and I told the audience about the arrest and conviction of a Scottish man for publishing a video of his girlfriend's pug doing a Nazi salute for a joke, and they laughed loudly. Some of them refused to believe it was true. I found the news report on my iPhone and showed them. They laughed again. Brazilians, inhabitants of a nation not that long ago, not that long out of military dictatorship, are shocked at how illiberal Britain has become. They're shocked at how the typical Brit is just giving up freedoms without a fight. And of course, it's not, as I say, limited to the UK. It's spreading in America as well. Another Spectator piece, this is the American Spectator. It says, the UK is in the process of becoming a nightmarish glimpse of what could happen in the United States if we aren't careful and vigilant. The once proud and free empire now seems as if it is determined to become a cheap imitation of a Cold War era totalitarian state. For the last several months, the headlines coming from Britain read like bad satire from a knockoff of The Onion. The assaults on freedom in the UK come from all over the place these days. Recently, London Mayor Sadiq Khan has taken up knife control as a cause, and then it refers to the tweet that he sent out. I believe I read that on this program. The Mayor of London saying there's never a reason to carry a knife. Anyone who does will be caught, and they'll feel the full force of the law. I mean, these are priorities. Someone carrying a knife. A pocket knife, I presume. They're going to get the full force of the law. I didn't bring it with me. You should have seen the notice the local police sent out in the area the area where that motorist was caught with those obscene gestures, and he had that device in his car. And basically, the local police said they put everyone in the local area on notice. I mean, this just goes to show you, you better be careful what you do around our cameras, because we'll come after you. And meanwhile, you have police forces in Rochdale. You have police forces in Rotherham that have just turned a blind eye to their own British children being raped by these Muslim gangs because they're Muslim. And they don't want to bring it up. They don't want to come across as Islamophobic. Newcastle, I mean, it's just popped up all over the nation. It's far worse. It's far worse than teaching a dog a dirty trick or making an obscene gesture to a traffic camera. British girls, white British girls, systematically raped. And the story just won't go away. It finally came out years ago in Rotherham, and now it's just one another city after another. Middle-aged Muslim men raping 13 and 14-year-old girls. And you have to dig pretty deep into the news cycle just to find some stories about it. But these other headlines, it's like the Spectator brings out. It's like bad satire. It writes here, we're already seeing a full frontal assault on free speech. The liberal social media mob seeks to silence any voices with which it doesn't agree, and it's usually successful. Progressives continue to get any speech they don't like legally classified as hate speech. This is talking about America. The Second Amendment is being assailed by a political class that has always been coy about its endgame, but is becoming more bold about the fact that, yes, they do want to take our guns. It says now that they have been almost completely hijacked by progressive, even mainstream Democrats are pushing for single-payer health care. Once the government has complete control of the reins of medical care in this country, rationing and sickening stories like those of Charlie Gard and Alfie Evans will be being told here as well. It's spreading. It's spreading. Freedom is hardly on the march. Freedom is in retreat. And our people, so many of them, welcome it. Back to this PragerU video. Here's clip 6.
While respecting and often ruling through local leaders, the British still insisted on certain Judeo-Christian moral standards. They were not, in that respect, multiculturalists. They had a firm sense of right and wrong.
So back when the government did impose its will, it was to enforce the Judeo-Christian ethic or the Judeo-Christian standards. It had a firm sense of what's right and what's wrong. Well, it today has a firm, the government, of course, is massive now in both cases, Britain and the U.S., and in many cases, they have a firm sense of what's right and wrong. But we've abandoned those Judeo-Christian standards. And now it's just the human reasoning. God's out of the picture. God's out of the NHS. God's out of government. And this is something, as this video goes on to point out, the freedom of old, this is something that millions and millions of our sons sacrificed their lives for, fighting for freedom. Notice clip 7 here.
When we think of the two deadliest threats to freedom in the 20th century, we generally think of communism and Nazism. But how many remember that in 1940, after the Hitler-Stalin Pact, and after the fall of France, one power, the British Empire, stood alone in mortal combat against the combined tyrannies of the world?
One power stood alone. The darkest hour for Great Britain. The United States joined forces with them in late 1941, combating the tyrannies of this world. As that video concludes here, I'll play it in a second, but this isn't just British history. This is our own history. One final clip, clip 8.
This is our own history, too. If you love America, you should also love the power that gave us our sense of inalienable rights, rights traceable back to Magna Carta. It all started in America with the British Empire, a great liberty-loving empire. It is the empire's legacy, the English-speaking world, that remains the great global guardian of freedom today.
The global guardian of freedom. And today, well, look at all these different examples where it's clamping down on the freedoms, the inalienable rights of the citizens. I mean, the ideas, the thoughts, the laws, the principles on which the United States is founded, they sprung from great British thinkers, the Magna Carta, this liberty-loving empire. Speaking of videos, well, maybe you can track down that PragerU video on your own, but we've produced a similar video. Well, I guess it's similar in a few ways, but Joel Hilliker had a five-minute video, what, a year or two ago, I think it was. How did socialism become so popular in America? And this was following the election from 2016 and the growing popularity of Bernie Sanders and just radical leftist thinking. We've talked a lot about that on this program over the last couple weeks. Just the corruption at the very highest levels of government. But more and more people are quite all right with this creeping spread of socialism. It's becoming more popular. As it happens, I didn't bring the tweet with me. Bernie Sanders, he tweeted out just this week following the birth of Prince William's third son, or third child, I guess, second son. But he talked about how it's less expensive to give birth to a child here in the UK than it is in the United States. I don't know where he got all of his facts and figures or how he calculated it, but he was basically saying, look, we need healthcare. Like the UK has healthcare, single payer. Everyone pays. Everyone pays into it, and everyone has free, quote unquote, free healthcare. And on the same week that he tweets this out, well, you have this story about little Alfie. Sad and tragic. But look, when Bernie Sanders gets up and promises healthcare for everyone, free college for everyone, recently he talked about a job for everyone. I mean, the government's just going to do everything for you. That's what they want, and they make no bones about it. You just look to the government. We know what's best. We're compassionate. We're caring. We have all of these sincere motives. Don't worry. Okay, if a few things get botched along the way, well, we'll fix it. Institutional arrogance. That's what we're talking about in every branch of government. We're so far removed from God and the Judeo-Christian standards that we used to champion. And now it's just look to this agency or that institution. Joel Hilliker's video, by the way. How did socialism become so popular? Let me just play you the first couple minutes from that. Here's clip 9.
How is it that more and more Americans, especially younger Americans, are embracing socialism and communism? These ideologies are very different from those established by America's founders. They are economic and political models that make this nation more and more like other nations in Europe and elsewhere, and less like America. Well, the reason is remarkable. During the Cold War, there was a lot of fear in America about the spread of communism. Now, most Americans today have come to think that threat was overblown, But just look at how widespread and mainstream socialist ideas have become in America today. In the 2016 presidential campaign, an open socialist almost won the Democratic Party nomination. If Americans under the age of 30 were the only ones who voted, this man would now be president of the United States. His radical plans to multiply the power and size of government are still extremely popular. More and more Americans want the national government to run healthcare and other major sectors of the economy. This is a huge change in our nation's thinking, and it's happened pretty quickly. Is it possible that all that concern over communist infiltration might have been justified? This might sound like a kooky conspiracy theory, but you don't have to look hard to find evidence that communism is influencing America today. The political left is actually pretty open in advocating communist policies. When you look at the leaders in the Democratic Party today, they got their education from universities that were heavily influenced by communist thinkers.
That's from Joel Hilliker's video at thetrumpet.com. How did socialism become so popular in America? I mean, this represents a huge change in the way that we think as a nation. Our young people used to sign up in droves to go to war fighting against tyranny. And now, as he mentioned there in that video, I mean, if this vote was left to the young people alone, Bernie Sanders would be leading the nation. Jeremy Corbyn would be leading the UK. And it all gets back to education, doesn't it? Illiberal education. It's in all the universities. There's another video coming out. I forget who made it, but Cheryl Atkinson's going to be in it. And Jordan Peterson, I saw him in the trailer for this movie. No Safe Spaces. That's the title of it. And as these commentators bring out on that video or documentary, whatever it is, I mean, the First Amendment's under assault on campus. There is no such thing as free speech on the university campus today. Jordan Peterson, he's quoted in that trailer saying the universities are so overwhelmed by this that I can't see how that they can extract themselves from it. I don't see a way out. They're so overwhelmed by this. This assault on free speech. This assault on freedom. They're so overwhelmed, I don't see a way out. And you start to see now. Well, Mr. Hilliker there mentioned Bernie Sanders. But even before that election, even before Donald Trump, shocked everyone. Well, look who was in office for 8 years. And what about that man's associations? What about his education? What about those who influenced Barack Obama? Here's what Mr. Hilliker said in the video, clip 10.
Former President Barack Obama was influenced as a youth by Frank Marshall Davis, a card-carrying Communist Party member, a man who openly supported Joseph Stalin, and who said the world's greatest threat was Anglo-American imperialist domination. Mr. Obama wrote in his biography that he attended socialist conferences and hung out with Marxist professors.
He bragged about it. His mentor, Frank Marshall Davis, he saw the world's greatest threat as Anglo-American imperialist domination. He saw that as a great threat. Gandhi saw it as a blessing. Gandhi said, look, I appreciate the freedom. Compare that. I mean, compare that. What you just heard in that statement about the associations, about the influences, about the educational training that Barack Obama received. And then compare that with the truth as brought out in that PragerU video. And great again, my father draws attention to that statement Mr. Obama made back in 2001, years before he became president, where he complained about the Constitution. He sees himself as a constitutional scholar. And he said that the problem with it is that it's a charter of negative liberties. It says what the states can't do to you. It says what the federal government can't do to you. But it doesn't say what the federal government or the state government must do on your behalf. Well, we're seeing a little bit of that here in the UK this week. Here's what this arm of government must do on your behalf. We've made the decision. Listen, we're compassionate. We've got a whole panel here that's weighed in. The consensus is this. That's what they want. The whole feature, the cover story in the latest Trumpet magazine, as I said yesterday, saving America from the radical left. This is what the left wants. They want a charter. They want a Magna Carta that tells you what the federal government must do on your behalf. And great again, my father says, there's a reason the Constitution focuses on what the government can't do to you. It aims to restrain despotism and to preserve freedom. You see that? That's its great strength, he said, not its fundamental flaw. And then my father says, America's Constitution has given more freedom to more people than any other government charter in history. And that's what we're giving up. That's what we're forsaking. Now we're fighting for the ideas espoused by the Bernie Sanders and the Jeremy Corbyns of the world. One more clip here from Mr. Hilliker's video. Here's clip 11.
There's a lot of evidence exposing the communists' deliberate effort to get inside the Democratic Party. Like Paul Kanger wrote, they wanted to transform it from the party of Harry Truman and John F. Kennedy to the party of Nancy Pelosi and Barack Obama. A book published in 2015 called The Real Watergate Scandal documents how President Richard Nixon worked to prevent this from happening. He was part of the effort to convict Alger Hiss, a communist spy who worked in the U.S. State Department. For that, Nixon became a target among those on the radical left. History shows that the way Nixon was prosecuted involved lawbreaking and lawlessness far more scandalous than what he himself had to resign the presidency over. But today, the dominant message, especially among younger Americans, is to hate what Nixon or even Truman or Madison or Washington stood for, and to embrace the enlightened principles of Obama, Sanders, Davis, Engels, and Marx.
That's a huge change in the way that our nations think. To hate what George Washington stood for, and to embrace Karl Marx. We're not living in nations that our founders established. Our founders wouldn't recognize it. One final clip. Here's number 12.
Americans today are not living in the nation of our founding fathers or even of our own fathers. The ideas that many Americans are embracing are more radical than a lot of people realize. And we didn't arrive at this moment just spontaneously coming to recognize the wisdom in socialist and communist thinking. The fact that these ideas have become so popular is the result of a deliberate and amazingly successful strategy that was aimed at bringing down the land of the free and the home of the brave.
The land of the free, the British Empire, the United States of America. I'll just conclude by referring to an article Ron Fraser wrote years ago, the late Ron Fraser, at thetrumpet.com. The Law and Freedom. He said, when the Founding Fathers established the constitutional framework on which to build a nation of United States on the North American continent, they did so having in mind the foundational example of the Ten Commandments. As the Blackstone Institute notes, the Ten Commandments are at the heart of Blackstone's philosophy. Blackstone taught that man is created by God and granted fundamental rights by God. Man's law must be based on God's law. It says our founding fathers referred to Blackstone more than to any other English or American authority. And then Mr. Fraser writes here, Blackstone's commentary became the basic textbook establishing the model for American jurisprudence. While it remained so, U.S. lawyers retained a sense of legal heritage that tracked back to the Ten Commandments and the Law of Moses, but that all began to change with the liberal putsch in the 1960s and the penetration of the U.S. Supreme Court by the liberal, socialist, godless, evolutionary mindset. You go back to education. It's been going on now for a couple of generations. And now we see the outcome. We see the result. No safe spaces, as the new movie brings out. Well, there's more that we could get into. I have been wanting to discuss this archaeology article from the Times of Israel the last few days, but hopefully we can make some time for that finally on tomorrow's program. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Thank you for joining us today. We'll see you tomorrow.